Hey Gary, I always wanted to ask you about the Bill of Rights in the United States Constitution. What do you think was the significance of the adoption of the Bill of Rights?
Well, in most of the ratifying conventions in the various states, there were concerns over a number of issues, and they wanted them addressed. So most were ratified with a request that a Bill of Rights be submitted to the states for ratification and be adopted. One state, however, Rhode Island, well, let's look at some dates. The Bill of Rights was submitted to the member states of the Union on September 25th, 1789. At that time, Rhode Island was not a state. In fact, North Carolina was not a state. However, it was submitted to all the states. So, North Carolina, what their delay was, I don't know. But Rhode Island is very clear in what they've written about it. They would not ratify the Constitution until such time as a Bill of Rights had been submitted to the states. So on September 25th, 1789, the Bill of Rights was submitted. On May 29th, 1790, Rhode Island ratified the Constitution, and less than a month later, on June 7th, 1790, ratified the Bill of Rights as well. So there was a concern. North Carolina may have not ratified. I haven't really looked into that, but it's very abundantly clear that Rhode Island would not leave the Articles of Confederation, would be, remain under the circumstances an independent nation unless there were a Bill of Rights, because their dissatisfaction with some aspects of the Constitution were not addressed.
Well, I
So,
guess then the pertinent question then, Gary, is that what is the Bill of Rights?
well, I think that's best answered by what few people know, is that there was a preamble to the Constitution. Preamble sets forth the purpose of the document. When the Bill of Rights, the 12 amendments were submitted to the states, 10 were adopted at that time. The preamble to the Bill of Rights, this was the identification of this document. Now, a friend of mine says, well, that should be in the Constitution. No, because the Bill of Rights then became a part of the Constitution. But when it was submitted back to the states as those that were ratified, there was a preamble, and it reads, Congress of the United States, begun and held at the City of New York on Wednesday, the 4th of March, 1789. The convention of a number of states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. Resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America, in Congress assembled, two-thirds of both houses concurring, that the following articles be proposed to the legislatures of the several states as amendments to the Constitution of the United States, and all or any of which articles, when ratified by three-fourths of said legislature, to be valid to all intents and purposes as a part of said Constitution. Then it concludes, articles in addition and amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America, proposed by Congress and ratified by the legislatures of the several states, pursuant to the fifth article of the original Constitution. Now, that then was the header put on the 10 ratified. It did have the original resolution that went with the 12, and that last paragraph was affixed to the 10 that were adopted as the Bill of Rights. Now, interestingly, their concern was there would be misconstruction of the Constitution. And I think we discussed one earlier, which is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18. But there were two of the Bill of Rights that weren't really like the rest of them. They were the 9th and 10th amendments to the Bill of Rights. And the 9th, these are the ones that really set forth the purpose of the Bill of Rights as was explained in the preamble. The 9th is the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Basically, they are saying if it's not listed in the Constitution and is not given to the government, then we get to keep it. The 10th, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. Now, these are powers delegated to the Constitution, by the Constitution, nor prohibited it to the states, which is Article 1, Section 10, are reserved to the states, respectively, or the people. So both of these are saying there's a line being drawn. You only get what we gave you and nothing more. So,
well, that sounds like the basis for what should be a very limited government then, just strictly from the 9th and 10th Amendments.
It was fully intended that way, and until the Civil War, it was pretty much practiced that way. But let's look at Article 1, revisit Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying, this is was of concern in most of the conventions, necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, that's 1 through 17, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or any department or office thereof. Now that second part of that, and all other powers vested by this Constitution, was pretty ambiguous. And it is the worst fears of those people that wanted a Bill of Rights have been realized by us, because they can stretch these, the Commerce Clause, for example. They're using it to punish people, imprison them. They've gone well beyond what was intended by the founders. In fact, you know, many people say it. By now, the founders would have picked up their rifles and gone after the government if they had seen what we live in today. But the transition over the last, say, 150 years, and especially the last 50 years, has been destructive to the ends of the Constitution.
Well, what 5 rights are enumerated within the First Amendment?
Well, the First Amendment reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, semicolon, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, semicolon, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances, period. So we've got really 3 elements to this. The first one is, shall make no law respecting an establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now that's been twisted in since the 60s. And let me explain the last 50 years. In the 1960s, during the Civil Rights Movement, we got away from natural rights. The Founding Fathers only recognized natural rights. They were presumed to exist. Some people say by God, others say no, they just exist because that's the natural process. We have a right to keep and bear arms for our own defense and the defense of the state. We have the right to say what we want. And they were challenging a lot of the restrictions that the Crown had put on certain things in England. So, no law respecting an establishment of religion. Now, in most of the colonies, the state religion was the Episcopalian or the Church of England religion. Episcopalian and Church of England being the same, synonymous. And it was a spinoff from the Catholic Church and carried much of the ceremony. And in those states with the Church of England, that everybody had to pay taxes that went to support that church. Also, the prohibiting the free exercise thereof, some of the colonies and some of the New England colonies were pretty much guilty of this, that they would not allow other religions. If they did allow other religions, they were taxed heavily to support the church of the state, of the colony. So, again, no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. To get away from the state passing a law establishing a religion, or to pass a law prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, let's go through the rest of these, and then we're going to return to that one because there's been a gross misconstruction of that. So next we have, or abridge the no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Now, there you have it. In England, at Hyde Park, there's a place called Sacred Speaker's Corner. You cannot be arrested for no matter what you say at Speaker's Corner. But you step out of that corner and say it, and you could be arrested. Almost every country in the world has limitations on freedom of speech. Sometimes very selectively enforced, I might add. Or of the press. Now, in Anti-Federalist Papers, John DeWitt described freedom of the press as the right to present any argument so long as it's done in a decent manner, because it gives every man a right to consider that option in terms of a discussion. So the freedom of speech and of the press was not about sex and dirty magazines or the right to call people a son of a bitch or things like that. It had to do with the politics, because in England, again, speech and the press were used to control, even in this country, John Peter Zenger, were used to control what can be said or published, especially if it's detrimental to the crown. So that provision's background is that we have the right of freedom of speech and of the press, but that is of a political nature, not of other natures. And, you know, one of the earliest rulings regarding that was the freedom to yell fire in a crowded theater. And that creates a dangerous situation for those in the theater who might stampede to try and get out, and people be injured as a consequence of it. So clearly, if it's going to cause damage, if it's too provocative, they're without political purpose, let me put it that way, that it could be curtailed, as it was with the yelling fire in a theater. Same with the press. As long as it's legitimate discussion, legitimate argument, that was what was intended. Now, John Adams encouraged and got past the Alien and Sedition Acts. Two of them were overturned by the Supreme Court. The remainder expired at the end of his term in office. But they were efforts to curtail freedom of the speech and of the press. And they worked for a while, but that's the era that was the early 1800s, and that's the era that you know, this new government was stretching its legs trying to find out what its limits were. So nobody ever, until this last century, tried to curtail freedom of speech or freedom of the press again from a political standpoint. The term sedition should not exist in our legal language, for example. Next, we have the right of the people to peaceably, to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Now, the world has changed considerably since then, but we have seen a curtailment of the people to peaceably assemble, but not to the extent that a lot of people want to express. When they're not peaceable, that right is qualified to peaceably to assemble. And when it becomes unpeaceable, what they used to do, and this came from English tradition, the magistrate or whoever was in charge from a legal standpoint would go out and read the riot act. That riot act was to inform the people there that they had gone beyond being peaceable. And once they were, this right disappears. And that's rightfully so, because other people's property or body are subject, when it becomes unpeaceable, are subject to damage. So a lot of these people say we got the right to assemble when their intention is to break windows, key cars, and things like that. That right does not exist in that term, but the government doesn't enforce it that way anymore. They don't read the Riot Act anymore. They don't do a lot of things that they did, let's say, pre-Civil Rights era, possibly in many cases pre-World War II. And to petition the government for redressive grievances. Now, this is key to peaceably to assemble, but we have to understand the nature of the world back then. There were no cities with a million people. In 1969, there was a peaceful assembly in Washington, D.C. in November asking for the war to end in Vietnam. That is that what they meant by petition? Or are there other forms of petition they meant? I can't, in all the reading I do, I can't find anything except one thing that would otherwise address that. There is no provision in the Constitution nor the statutes of the United States that address petition. Some states have the right to petition for recall, for referendum, and things like that, but the federal government has no referendum, recall, or initiative process, which is a petition in itself. So the only thing that remains in the realm of petition would be vocal, or Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2 of the Constitution, which is habeas corpus, which is a challenge to federal encroachments out of their excroachments out of their jurisdiction, or extension of their laws beyond that allowed by the Constitution. That's a petition because legal documents are referred to, among other things. A motion is a petition to the court to do something. So I can't really say what petition is, but those are the elements described in the First Amendment. Now we want to return to the first one, respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And Sleepy, I think you've got a copy of a letter, and I don't recall who he wrote it to, but Jefferson wrote the letter. Now understand, Jefferson was in France during the Constitutional Convention. He had made observations, but he really wanted to get back to this country before he got involved in it even more. So he was not even a player in the intent or anything else except by correspondence. He was hearsay, secondhand evidence of what occurred at the convention or anything else. So he wrote a letter to so-and-so on such and such a date, and I'll let you pick that up, Sleepy.
Yeah, sure. Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to the Danbury Baptist Association dated January 1st of 1802. An excerpt from the letter says the following, quote, "I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state," close quote.
Okay, so now in that context, when he was referring to what we just said about establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, that wall then is between the government enacting a law establishing a religion or the government prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It does not extend to any churches beyond what is reasonable in terms of, say, peaceable assembly and the right to petition, freedom of speech, and freedom of the press. It simply bars the government from being restrictive in that nature. Now, the government used something called the Internal Revenue Code to have the effect of enacting laws respecting the establishment of religion by saying, unless you fill out these documents and agree to these terms, you are not a 501c3 church, and therefore you are not tax exempt. So they rewarded churches that would sign an agreement allowing the government to tell them what they could and could not preach, what they could and could not do. A far cry from what was intended, because if we think back to the pre-revolutionary period, the pulpit was one of the main sounding boards against the actions of the British government. And the government has, by virtue of crossing understanding the proper context, the separation of church and state, has crossed that boundary in qualifying churches or not qualifying churches, and when they do qualify them, put rigid rules that will remove that qualification and that tax exemption. So they have breached that wall that he spoke about, and the context of that wall, understand, is basically the Congress shall keep their hands off of anything dealing with religion that is not otherwise illegal, and they cannot make a law making something illegal, so it would have to be counterfeiting or murder or something like that, you know, is the only way that they could cross that line. But they have curtailed freedom of speech, freedom of the press of the church to publish in the church's newspapers or newsletters or any document, certain things. They have curtailed the right to peacefully assemble, because that assembly would allow them to speak what they want to speak in discussion, and to petition the government for redress of grievances, because any of those would remove that buffer that they've created for them, as long as they're obedient to the 501c3 rules. So,
considering particularly the free exercise clause, would it be accurate to say that citizens are free to not practice a religion then?
Well, that would be free exercise, isn't it? What religious exercise do you want to conduct? Absolutely none. You have every right to exercise absolutely nothing.
Okay.
Now, consider the obesity in this country. Those people have freely chosen not to exercise. And you have the same right they do. I'm not obese, you're not obese, but I mean the same thing. If I have the government cannot prohibit the free exercise thereof, I have the right to exercise that as long as it's not to the detriment of another person. We get back to, you know, the reasonable laws, basically the concept of common law, no injured party. And when they suppress the church, there's no injured party. There's just limited discussion, limited guests, all kinds of things come into play. And in so doing, what they've done is created a condition where they have absolute control. If the church wanted to be all white, the government would not allow it. Now, if the church wanted to be all black, the government would probably allow it. So they get very selective in their administration via the tax code.
We mentioned a moment ago about free speech. So does free speech permit slander, libel, and defamation?
The government cannot intrude upon libel, slander, and defamation. Those were left to the states. But should the federal government intervene in me calling you a son of a bitch? Now, there's a concept in contract law that in a dispute, the contract will be adjudicated in the state where the contract was signed, and that would be the last signer. So, unless it's specified in the contract itself that it would be in a location which would be an agreement to, other than that. So in a slander, the same thing. If you cross straight lines, the question is, where can you bring an action against people? There's one going on right now where the accusation was made in Oregon, and so the person that was accused and is countersuing on that has to go to Oregon to deal with it. But that's a state issue. The federal government should not be involved in matters of slander and libel. The states, with respect to two things, one is their free speech equivalent in their Declaration of Rights or Bill of Rights, and the other one is the right for an injured party to seek redress in the courts. And so libel and slander are definitely redress in the courts, because they can cause injury, serious injury physically or serious injury financially or contractually. You know, if I buy 300 head of horses from you and I pay you for them, and you deliver 50 head and say the others died on the way, well, then you, a justiciable issue. Did they die because of negligence and all that? So, you know, there's injury when there's a violation of contract. There's injury when there's liable slander or defamation when it's made public. So those injuries are a recourse for the local form of government, not for the federal form of government. The federal government is really told to stay out of it in that regard.
I remember reading in your Waco white papers how when you were trying to get to the press conferences that there at Waco that were being conducted by the FBI and such, that you would get kind of harassed time and again. So you're probably the best person to answer this question.
I wasn't harassed.
Well, Gary,
who
are the press?
Well, that wasn't harassment, though. Your question is what now?
Who are the press?
Who are the press? Legitimately, anybody that publishes. Illegitimately, and this is an interesting issue, but the press can bias their articles, but they should not be allowed to promulgate known falsehoods. They should not, they should not lie. But I had been writing and publishing a newspaper out of Florida. I had published two editions before I went to Waco, and they said, "Are you press?" And I said, "Yes, I'm press." "Are you a member of the National Press Association?" I said, "Do I have to be?" And I said, "Look, I'll tell you what. I'll bring you copies of my newspaper, and you can judge whether I'm press or not." And so I brought them. So they could not dispute that I was press. Ultimately, Linda something from Waco PD, who was in charge of buying donuts and coffee for the press conferences, and in charge of, you know, the arrangements for the building and all that, said you can't. The FBI walked away from dealing with me. They could not say no. They never did say no. They just kept asking questions, didn't like the answers, and walked away. And there were three or four rounds. And finally, I went down there, and the FBI guys, Gonzalez and these, Rodriguez, whatever his name was, and the other guys weren't there. So I thought I'd go in, and Linda was at the door, and she stopped me, and I said, "Wait, I'm press. Why can't I go in there?" And she said, "Well, Gary, look at it this way. It's their party, and you're not invited." So, see, there was no legal justification for that.
Yeah, that sounds like color of law.
They used the third party to deny me access to the press conference. Now, Dick Rivas, who was press as well, and a friend of mine, tried to get the other papers, the other press in there to stand in defense of this. And they wouldn't do it. And finally, I told Dick, "Don't. You're going to get kicked out, too, if you keep that up." But I was not the first one kicked out. Let's go back probably a week before I was kicked out. There's a guy named Louis Beans who wrote a newspaper. Now, it is an Aryan Nation-oriented newspaper. But Louis Beans is a hell of a nice guy. And he was in the press conference, and he raised his hand. Oh, by the way, I asked one question during the press conferences when I was allowed in. And that stopped around the 21st of March. But earlier on in March, I'd asked, "Are you going to allow the Red Cross to bring food and health supplies to the Davidians?" And they couldn't really answer the question. I got later when I talked to the Red Cross when they told me it was a crime scene. But Louis Beam, in a press conference, asked if what we're seeing here in Waco indicative of the coming police state. They did not answer him either, but two armed officers came down, grabbed his arms, and escorted. He did not resist, and escorted him out of the building. So I think he got his answer.
Whoa, yes, that was back in 1993.
Yes.
Wow.
So denial of freedom of the press is, well, let's look at government today. Everything they do, you've read most of my articles, the one I wrote about Kim Davis. They do everything they can to circumvent the Constitution, circumvent even the statutes when they can. For example, in Massey's case, the Hazhat argument. They do everything they can to get around the Constitution by whatever means possible. And that's what they did. They have no right, but they have, since Waco, they have actually qualified people to come, and maybe it's a consequence of Lewis and I, but they actually have a roster of who's allowed in the press conferences. and I think it was Obama, maybe it was Bush, but there was a lady that had been doing press conferences for many decades, and she was had her credentials for White House press conferences withdrawn from her. So they have taken away that right. They don't like questions that they can't answer. The problem with the press conference and TV cameras especially is the people can see that they don't have the answers. I can't think of her name now. I wish I could. But she was barred from the ugly old lady. But she was real nice. I spoke to her a couple of times.
Well, earlier you mentioned about peaceful assembly. So does peaceful assembly imply a freedom of association?
It would definitely apply to freedom of association. But remember, peaceable assembly. The peaceable is the only requisite in there. It becomes unpeaceable with something else. Now, suppose I've got a peaceable assembly and I get intruders in it. And they would, just say I've got a Tea Party group. Well, no, let's turn it around. Let's say a liberal group's meeting and they're talking about running Biden for president. And a Tea Party group goes in and intrudes on that. Do they have a right to throw the Tea Party people out? Yes, because that intrusion might remove it from the peaceable assembly. But the people who get thrown out say, we've got a right to freedom of speech. Well, what's the senior, the right to retain the peaceable assembly or to allow somebody to make it unpeaceable? Now, these rights cannot conflict with each other. So obviously the senior in this is if we got a peaceful assembly for a purpose and somebody wants to intrude upon that purpose, then they are threatening the peaceability of the assembly, and as a consequence, then they are outside the realm of free speech because what they're doing is going to be destructive to the rights of others.
Well, does government intervention in the right to refuse service also an infringement upon the freedom of association then?
Well, that goes back to Article 1, Section 10. Where is it? Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1. No state shall pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility. So, if I have a contract with you, do they have a right to intrude on that unless that contract is to go murder somebody or commit some illegal act?
No, I don't think so. We're not talking about illegal contracts here.
Okay, pose your question again.
Does government intervention in the right to refuse service also an infringement upon the freedom of association? Oh, okay, I see.
Okay, is that not a contract? If I'm selling apples on the street corner and somebody says, I'd like one of your apples, how much are they? They're 5 cents. Isn't that a contract?
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it? Because it's voluntary.
Yeah, it's only health insurance and auto insurance and things like that that are mandatory, and I wonder how they have any right to do that. But then, they push the Constitution aside for their own gain.
I wonder where those mandatory so-called contracts would be. Illegal contracts, maybe?
Well, mandatory contracts are interesting because the cost of the service provided under that contract goes up drastically once that contract becomes mandatory.
Shocker.
Because you've given the latitude to them to set their own price. And if there are any controls, they're set by the government. And that government probably has a board that administers that realm of contracts, i.e. insurance or medical or things like that. Is people with doctors or insurance adjusters or people in that industry who want to increase their profit. So anything mandatory to me like that, it would also be a title of nobility, because if I say you've got to do this, there was a saying when I was a kid, my mother always said, be careful, because if somebody gets hurt they can sue us and take our house away. I mean, I had the right then to lay the risk responsibility upon myself, and I had the option of buying insurance to protect that. But now the insurance is mandatory, and what if, let's look at the auto industry, what effect that has. If a guy drives drunk and gets in accidents, he pays the fine, and his insurance company pays all the damages, you know, he might have to pay for the attorney, which, and if he beats the case, is probably cheaper than the fine in some cases. But the thing is, they cost $50,000 worth of damage. If that came out of his pocket, I don't think he'd drive drunk again. But if his and my premium both go up $10 a year to cover that $50,000, then it's no sweat to him. So that mandatory insurance, one, allows the insurance companies to raise rates, and they've gone up drastically. Because now we're paying for unlicensed drivers who are illegally in this country. And the insurance company doesn't require, you can get cited for not having insurance. They can't. Oh, that's interesting. So that's the effect of mandatory, that it is a title of nobility, and it gives on the select few that are authorized by the state the authority to do what we should all be able to do on our own behalf, which is insure our own property with to the extent of our wealth. You know, they'll sue you and take your house away, to sell it, to pay off what you owe, the restitution for the damages.
When you had mentioned churches, I think you said something about petitioning the government. Is there a proper method for petitioning government?
Well, I think I addressed that. The only one that I can really find, the two, would be yelling out, hey, don't do that, or Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2, habeas corpus, challenging jurisdiction or unconstitutional laws. I can't find, you know, I think back then it might have occurred often, though I can't find any proof because they would not include that in the, say, the Congressional Globe, that a bunch of people from an area might submit a petition to Congress requesting they do something, and through their congressman, who would then take it to the Congress to see if they would enact it. So there might have been a method of petition that doesn't exist now, because right now, you know, the congressmen have these computer-generated form letters. We appreciate your letter, and we're looking into that. And if anything changes, we'll be in touch with you. You know, that kind of boilerplate shit. So petitioning your representatives now is out of the question in that respect, that it might have been done in the past.
What is a well-regulated militia anyway?
You know, when we say regulated, we think regulation, you know, and it has that tone of mandatory. But if we look back at Webster's and see what regulate means, meant then, to adjust by rule, method, or established mode, as to regulate weights and measures, to regulate the size of bread, to regulate our moral conduct by laws of God and of society, to regulate our manners by the customary forms, to put in good order, this is number two, to put in good order as to regulate the disordered state of a nation or its finances, three, to subject to rules or restrictions as to regulate trade or regulate diet. Now that second one, put in good order, what good is a militia if you got a bunch of guys with guns and they meet once every year and sit down and drink beer? So the idea of regulating was, at the time, the well-regulated militia. There was one commonly used document out of Virginia, and it was a document. It's on my webpage under the library. It was about militia procedures. And until they adopted their own, most states referred to the Virginia militia guide. But the well-regulated is equip properly, train properly, everything in order so that the militia can act as a militia. And a militia is not an individual. Everybody's a member of the militia, but there's two militia, the singular and the plural, and they're both militia. The singular is the individual. the plural then is the well-regulated militia. They use a capital M in that, and I've used that too. If you are militia by state statute, you're lowercase m. If you're an organized body as militia, it's a capital M. And if you're well-regulated, that means you're trained, not just shooting paintballs in the woods, but closer to drills, uniforms, accoutrements, everything, and ready to rock and roll, so to speak. So a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of free state. And that second phrase there, necessary to the security of free state, is the reason that it has to be well-trained. And I think trained would be more appropriate, but not as broad, because that would imply just training. And well-regulated then brings in training, accoutrement, and everything else, including the structure of commissioned officers, non-commissioned officers, and general enlisted people. So, but they're necessary for the security of a free state. Now, the second part of that amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the right to keep and bear arms is to keep and bear those arms so that you can, if necessary, if called up, form rapidly into that well-regulated militia. And you can't do that if you don't have the right to keep and bear arms. Now, what arms were applicable at the time? Back then, an individual could own a cannon. A lot of people own cannons. What the government could have, the people could have. I think I'm getting ahead of something that I haven't written yet, but I think it warrants consideration now. This is defendant Kevin Lindell Massey's second opposed motion to dismiss indictment. It was filed on the 5th of September. The defendant asked the court to take judicial notice of the prior motion to dismiss and incorporates these facts into the motion. 18 U.S. Code 922 G1, which is felon in possession of firearms, violates the 10th Amendment. Wow! The 10th Amendment provides powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Bill of Rights, Article 10. As this amendment makes clear, and as the Supreme Court has long recognized, the federal government is one of enumerated limited powers. See McCulloch versus Maryland. Accordingly, the federal government may act only where the Constitution so authorizes. And here he cites New York versus United States, a 1992 decision. A corollary to this rule is the Congress may not act in areas prohibited to it. As Justice Thomas noted in his concurrence on Prince versus United States, which is a 1997 decision, and Justice Thomas concurring, the Constitution places whole areas outside the reach of Congress, such as the First Amendment's preventing Congress from prohibiting the free exercise of religion or abridging the freedom of speech. Justice Thomas went on to explain that the Second Amendment similarly appears to contain an express limitation on the government's authority. Let me interrupt here and go back and finish the Second Amendment. Shall not be infringed. As stated, this course has not had recent occasion to consider the nature of the substantive rights safeguarded by the Second Amendment. If, however, the Second Amendment is read to confer a personal right to keep and bear arms, a colorable argument exists that the federal government's regulatory scheme, at least as it pertains to the purely intrastate, not interstate, but intrastate, staying within the state, sale or possession of firearms runs afoul of the amendment's protections. Although Prince dealt with a successful challenge to the Brady Act requirement that state law enforcement officers conduct background checks on prospective handgun purchasers, the logic of Justice Thomas's reasoning is compelling with respect to the 10th Amendment's limited federal power. The Second Amendment specifically prohibits the federal government from infringing the individual right to bear arms. Thus, it surely cannot be constitutional for the federal government to prohibit a person's purely intra-state possession of firearms. So, you know, this what's happening with Massey's case is a kickback on that last phrase, shall not be infringed. They're saying the 10th Amendment doesn't let you do that if it's intrastate, stays within the state. So we're waiting for Justice Hannon to rule on that. But that's kind of interesting that this is going to court. This very issue is going to court, and I imagine it will go to the appellate and perhaps to the Supreme Court if the government thinks they can win. But they might walk away from it, too, and keep it out of stare decisis. But anyway, that's the Second Amendment. And by what I just read you, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The right for the Commerce Clause allows the government to deal with weapons crossing between states. That's a broad expansion of what was intended by the Commerce Clause, but at least there's an arguable position in that. But there is no arguable position, even if the arms had crossed state lines, if the person possessing it had nothing to do with it crossing state lines. And that's where we are with the Massey case. So, there. Got that out.
Well, during the colonial American period of the 1760s and 1770s, why was the quartering of soldiers a problem?
Well, because what happened in Boston, here they bring a few thousand soldiers into Boston, and a few thousand people didn't move out, so they started and quartering the enlisted men in barns and houses, the officers in houses, and it was mandatory. Move over. Where's the best bedroom in the house? We'll take it. You can sleep on the couch. Basically, the people were shoved aside in their own home. Now, let me read something. This is from English history, and then we'll continue on. This is William Pitt before the British House of Commons addressing the need for privacy, the protection of life, liberty, and happiness. The poorest, this is a quote, the poorest man may, in his cottage, bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storm may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England may not enter. All his forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement. Damn, that's pretty strong, isn't it? So we're going to get to an exception to that when we get a little further along. But think of that. This is what they had in the concept of the founders, but the king's forces were going in homes. They were damaging property. If they wanted firewood, they'd tear down fences. That's private property. So this specifically, no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. So since there weren't barracks all over the country, and you know, especially in colonial America, they weren't rich enough to build barracks and have large numbers of troops and then move them to another city and have barracks there, they did have the second part that gave that allowed them to prescribe by law a manner which people would be could be quartered, but surely because of all the other provisions in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, just compensation would also be provided as well as damage to property. But that was a concern of the times. Now, but wait, in recent times, at least two incidents, the SWAT teams have gone into a house and told the people, get out of your house. We want to use this as an operational point or an observation point because we're watching these people down the street. That's as bad as quartering. So, you know, I thought this was obsolete until a couple of years ago. I thought it was just, you know, that was historical ash until a couple of years ago when they can, with no crime committed by the owner of the house, kick them out of the house and quarter themselves there, whether it be for an hour, a day, a year, or a month or a year. It doesn't matter. They have quartered themselves. They've made it their quarters, their headquarters, without the consent of the owner. And there is no law that allows them to do that. So there's no manner nor in time of war, but in a manner prescribed by law. So even a prescribed by law would not apply because we're not at war. So I thought this was a dead amendment. And, you know, I've had to reconsider that because of modern times. And that's how bad the Constitution is getting trashed.
Wow.
So why do the Fourth to Eighth Amendments all revolve around criminal justice?
Well, let's go through them and we'll see. These were not addressed in the Constitution, but they were concerns that arose, and some aspects of them were brought up in the Declaration of Independence as well. They had what was called writs of assistance, and you know, in Newsom's case, they talked about writs of assistance. But the right of the people to be secure in their person, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Now, we're going to have to go through this a piece at a time to understand it. The right of the people to be secure in their persons. Now, I just read you William Pitt. That's it. That's the starting point. Even the king's troops cannot enter the house. Persons, houses, papers, and effects. Houses, papers, and effects. Now, Tim McVeigh cited, I can't think of the case, but basically, the federal government could wiretap without the consent of the state of Washington, even though the state of Washington had laws against wiretapping, because we're the federal government. So they violated, in that amendment, they violated the security of the houses, because if you tap, if you tap my phone, one end is in my house, and to tap it anywhere is breaching. You're entering my house. You're entering my end of the conversation, both coming and going, by entering my house where those wires lead. Papers. Right now, when they do arrest warrants or search warrants, they say all papers. In Jesse Newsom's case, they wanted papers, pictures, everything. And effects. So the effects, they take computers and all these other things. They specify them in the warrant, but they don't give cause. And as we continue on, we'll see where that cause comes in. So securing the persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. It's unreasonable to go in and fish, just grab everything. Let's take it down to the office, we'll go through it, see if we can find anything we can use. If not, we'll destroy the property and fuck them. And that's basically the way it's treated nowadays. People fight for years. Joe Bellancourt lost his computer in February 1993. He has still not gotten it back, and they refuse to give it to him unless he gives them the access password. So he gave up on the computer. That's not reasonable.
Yeah, and just to be clear, the court case you were trying to remember, it was the Olmstead case, right?
Yeah, Olmstead.
Justice Brandeis specifically, yeah.
But it's unreasonable search and seizure shall not be violated. But they do that on a regular basis, and they get around it. And it's even worse as we continue. No warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation. Stop right there for a minute. Oath or affirmation. It requires an affidavit. Somebody has to hold his hand up and swear that the information I'm providing is true and correct. And a good example here is a guy named Donald Scott, Malibu, California. He had a ranch out there. A criminal told people that had a marijuana farm there, and he was growing marijuana. They sent an airplane up, and the airplane came down, and this is with deputies on it. Yes, we saw the marijuana field. So they go in, they raid Donald Scott's house, and there's an affidavit in this. There's not an affidavit, but there's a statement. Signed statement that is not affirmed or oath under oath that they observed at least 300 marijuana plants. So they raided the house. They searched the whole property. They didn't even find a damn seed. But Donald Scott got shot to death in his underwear, coming out of his bedroom with a gun in the hand, very early in the morning because there was a loud commotion going on in his living room. He's dead. And it was admitted that if you search Donald Scott outpost, you'll find what the Ventura County district attorney wrote. And he said, these guys were way out of order. And he goes through all their lies. But they got away with it. And the battle over the property continued for years. I think it was finally left with the family or his ex-girlfriend, the girlfriend that was present when he was killed. I don't recall which. I didn't follow up on it. But that oath or affirmation requires somebody to say, to my knowledge. Now, let's go back to my knowledge. Hearsay is not allowed in court. Should it be allowed in an oath, in an affidavit, in an oath or affirmation? Joe Blow, and this goes back to Donald Scott, Joe Blow told me they were growing marijuana there, and I swear to that. Does that make it valid? I'm supposed to, an affidavit, I'm supposed to have personal knowledge. If I do an oath or affirmation, you've read our cops constitutional. If a sheriff went along with an unsubstantiated claim to arrest somebody, the sheriff was could be charged with and pay penalties for false arrest. So any person in this whole chain has an obligation to do his best to assure that the information provided is accurate. And this is in our history back in the 1800s, as mentioned in Roger Root's Our Cops Constitutional. So if somebody tells me something and I swear to it, I should be criminally liable if I have not confirmed that that exists myself. He might be the source. But if he doesn't bring me pictures or some proof, I'm just passing on hearsay. And people die quite often because of that hearsay and it being incorrect, as happened to Donald Scott. And then it goes on, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Particularly describing the place. Now, is this the whole house? Perhaps it could be. But if you're looking for a horse, a stolen horse, for example, you wouldn't include the house. If you're looking for a stolen car, you wouldn't include the house. Describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Okay, now particularly describing three things. The place to be searched, the persons or things to be seized. If I can't describe what's going to be seized, now let's go back to it. I don't have a source on this. It's something I read a long time ago, but it was talking about writs of assistance. And without the writ of assistance, if they accuse somebody of smuggling, they had to knock on the door and say, we have a warrant here to search in a locker in the bedroom for contraband. It was that specific. It had to say where. They couldn't say the whole house. They had to have personal knowledge that that object was there. Now, they don't do that anymore. Hey, it's got to be in the house. Let's just go in the house. We didn't find anything on a tough shed. They lied and were subject to perhaps even death because of that. Now, the person, they have John Doe warrants all the time. Is that particularly describing the person? How many people are named John Doe? What if they got the wrong John Doe? So, you know, Fourth Amendment out the window, basically.
So I think what you're trying to say is that there shouldn't be any sort of, like, qualified immunity for these so-called police officers then.
Police officers, in my opinion, should have no immunity. If they shoot a nun on purpose, they should stand trial in front of a jury and let the community, through their representatives on that jury, decide what is acceptable within that community, not the police commissioner, not the boss of the people that are just killed somebody unarmed. You know, we've gotten so far away from, you know, what was intended by the founders. But these, you know, these four or five we're talking about are talking specifically about what they expected out of the judicial process for the protection of the individual, his property, and his liberty.
Why did the framers make exceptions to individual privacy by way of warrants?
Well, if I had absolute and total immunity from searches, boy, I could rob jewelry stores and put it in the house on a table in view of the window and leave the curtains open, couldn't I?
It's one way, I guess.
So how could I protect the property of others unless I've got means? But see, that does hinge on that very point. They have to particularly describe the place and the thing. So what they have to do is have knowledge, not a guess. What was that one article I wrote on? One of them, a fishing.
Fishing, yeah, I think it was like a fishing expedition.
Yeah,
I think it had to deal with Casey Massey or somebody. Yeah, it was pretty bad.
I think it was Newsom.
Okay.
Because that was the one that just really got me on. Now, new information has come to light on wolves, and you saw that article too. That, but anyway, back to the how else could other people's property be protected unless they're with that supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the things to be seized. Absent that, there is no way for the government acting on our behalf, and remember back then it was sheriffs, it was not police departments, to have property returned. Back then it was up to me who stole it and where'd they keep it. And if I found that out and did the affidavit that, you know, I saw my television in his the bedroom at the southeast corner of his house, and they go there with the warrant and find it there, hey, that's it. But how else can my property be protected unless there is an authority? And this goes through, you know, this is a result of many centuries of history in England on finding criminals. If we go strictly without warrants back to what William Pitt said, then nobody can ever come in my house. I can steal everything. I can show it to you, but you can't come in my house. So the necessity of a warrant, not a writ of assistance, but a warrant, is the way of assuring, intended way of assuring, that it not be done maliciously, which it is in most cases nowadays.
So why should we care about due process?
Well, I think we need to look at the Fifth Amendment in perspective as we have the others to understand. No person shall be held to answer for capital or otherwise infamous crimes. Now, capital is one that is punishable by death, and otherwise infamous crimes, the old definition of felony, not the new one, was any crime that would where you would serve a year and a day. And this is from English history and our early history. If you served a year and a day, it was an infamous crime. Below that was a misdemeanor. So no person shall well, held to answer. We've got to go there too. No person shall be held. Hey, you're detained. I'm going to put you in jail. To answer. How do you answer? You go to court and stand before the judge. So held to answer is arrested to stand against the charges for capital or felonious crimes unless under presentment or indictment of a grand jury. Grand jury on Wolf was called 3 weeks after they arrested him. He was held to answer for an infamous crime without a presentment or indictment by a grand jury. So see, they've turned it around. Oh, we can do the grand jury later because we know he's a bad guy. And this, you know, this happened, I'm not sure the date of Massey's indictment, but Beecher's, again, was after after they served the criminal complaint and searched the property. And I think Massey's was too. So they've got the cart before the horse here, because unless on a presentment or indictment, that relies on the presentment or indictment to be casual in holding them to answer for capital or felonious crime. So yeah, they got around that by just switching the words around a little bit. We'll do the grand jury later. Except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger. So that there's an exception. So we'll just discard that because we haven't had that half of that since 1941, and the other half would probably go back close to the Civil War or maybe the Indian Wars. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. Oh, wait. No. Charles Steyer was tried three times. Now, that was not a federal charge, but it's become standard in this country, and even though most state constitutions have the double jeopardy clause, they have decided that if there's an error or if they don't have a unanimous jury, well, that's not double jeopardy. It just costs twice as much to go back to trial again. You stay in jail until the second trial, or in Dyer's case, the third trial is completed. You've destroyed the family treasure by taking every penny, hawking houses and everything. what do they mean by twice put in jeopardy? I mean, it would seem to me that that's pretty clear. That one, you can't have two jurisdictions, but that's understood because it's a jurisdictional issue. Or the other, that you can't be tried twice. If they can't convict you the first time, they can't convict you. It used to be in England. If the rope broke when they hung you, you're free. So by the same token, if the jury can't convict you, you should be free. So cannot be put twice in jeopardy of life or limb. Okay, now shall be compelled in any case to be a witness against himself, self-incrimination. However, they can sneak into your house via tapping your lines, and you end up being a witness against yourself for whatever you say on the telephone, or if they bug your house, anything that you say in that house, they've intruded in your house, with or without a warrant, it would not be justified because they couldn't be searching for a thing that you can be a witness against yourself, because they'll play that as testimony, as they did against the Davidians when they took the recordings that were taken by the bugs and used them to prove that the Davidians set the fire, even though it was intelligible. So, again, you know, it's out the window.
Yeah, and in recent years, there have been plaintiffs who have tried to sue NSA, and each time those court cases were thrown out because the plaintiffs could not prove that they were directly harmed by NSA's dragnet wiretapping.
Right.
So the government literally makes it impossible to challenge that in any way that matters, at least to the judiciary, the judicial branch.
We've got that lady that put some acid or something on a doorknob of the girl that was sleeping with her husband or something like that, and she could not bring a suit until she was in prison. So through the appellate process, she remained out. Once she didn't win the appeal process and went to prison, then she filed with the Supreme Court and the Heritage. And that's explained in Ashwander versus TVA. That, you know, that you have to be injured by the statute. And that's how they avoided ruling on the 27th Amendment question. Let me find something real quick. You can talk for a few minutes.
Well, it was interesting when you were emphasizing in the Fifth Amendment about the presumption or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when an actual service in time of war or public danger. You know, I wonder if the federal government is considering the terror war. Remember that? The war on terror that George Bush Jr. started?
They never argued that point. They just do it.
I don't know. I mean, time of war. Remember, the war on terror is supposed to last like a century, according to that one general whose name escapes me now.
The more we fight the war on drugs, the more drugs there are. The more we fight the war on terror, the more terror there is.
Wasn't there a war on poverty at some point too?
Oh yeah, that one too.
Yeah, it seems to be a lot of wars, not a lot of freedom.
Well,
quite frankly,
no end to those wars.
Perpetual, never-ending wars, no actual enemy to either defeat or to be defeated by. It's like there's no actual ever resolution. You know, we're not talking about like the medieval wars where at some point there's an end point.
But they get the press to go along with this, and that's how they do it. The press calls it a war on drugs, and they'll talk about it in speeches, but on the paperwork in Congress, it doesn't say war, because only Congress can declare war, and they have to do a declaration of war, and then it's turned over to the president. They play that process, but they can't identify the enemy, and a declaration of war has to define the enemy. We're declaring war against fill in the blank later, and that's kind of what they're doing.
Well, who knows? I mean, when you mentioned about the presentment or indictment of a grand jury and how, you know, William Wolf's basically been kind of, you know, was held for 3 weeks and all that. I don't know. Maybe they consider him part of the militia in service in time of war, maybe. I don't think they've ever argued that.
I don't think they've even tried to argue it that way. They've just assumed that they have all the authority that they want to have.
Even when it exceeds the limits of the Constitution. Okay,
right.
I get it now.
I've never run across anything that would indicate that there's any divisive thought. There's just divisive application.
No, that's probably true.
So due process of law was a legal process that was established in England, and goes along the lines of what we're talking about with the warrants and these other things, that there was a procedure, that the grand jury had to proceed the arrest and incarceration. That's due process, that there are a number of legal steps that are necessary. Now, they've shortened the front end and increased the back end so that they can do anything they want on the short end. But once you're convicted in trial, now they've extended that. Used to be, you're convicted, you'll be hung tomorrow morning at noon or on a fixed date at 9 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And now somebody on death row, the government pays for both sides of the debate through the various courts, sometimes all the way to the Supreme Court, over capital punishment. And, you know, I'm sure there are longer ones than this, but I know, I can't think of the names now, but I remember a few years ago I was reading an article, and two cases at that time, one had been 28 years and one had been 27 years since the sentence of death, and they were still in due process. But that due process disappeared prior to conviction. So this process was an equitable one based on centuries of history. Basically, they adopted what applied to the Englishmen in England under the Constitution, not what they were applying here. Remember, here they could take the Declaration of Independence. They could take you and try you in England. No, you got to be tried where you're charged, where the crime occurred. But they've taken all of the due process off the front end of the conviction and thrown it all on the back end, which is fucking stupid if you think about it. Pardon my language. It's just this, what they've done to our justice system is so far what it was 200 years ago, 150 years ago even, 160 years ago. It began getting corrupted during Reconstruction after the Civil War. But it was a slow process before it got to the point, the degenerate point that we've achieved today. The due process is the procedure that was established under common law over centuries. Now, next one is, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, this goes along with what I was saying about quartering of troops, too. They're taking your property. They can damage your property. They come in and serve a search warrant, and they break your shit. They don't have to pay for it. Where's the just compensation? This is part of due process. They can't take it unless they compensate you for it. But it's a taking if you can afford to go to the Supreme Court, perhaps. But that's going to cost you a couple $100,000. It used to cost $50,000 to go to the appellate court. Now I've been told it's $100,000 to go to the appellate court. You're looking at $30,000 to $50,000 to defend yourself in court for the first charge. So they made it excessively expensive to have the right of justice, or get stuck with a public defender that's got a case overload, one or the other. But taking private property has always included destruction of property because it's taken from you. The reasonable use of it. It applies to land and everything else. It's the reasonable use. Byrne versus Baltimore, which you know you and I talked about in the habeas corpus discussion. Guy had a dock. He could take deep draft ships. They did some dredging. They put the spoil up in front of his dock. He couldn't take deep draft ships anymore. The Maryland Constitution did not provide for taking without compensation, so he went to the Supreme Court based on the Fifth Amendment, and they said that doesn't apply. That's between you and Maryland. But that was a taking. The Supreme Court had jurisdiction on that. If the federal government did the dredging and dropping the spoil on his property, they would have definitely determined that that was a taking because he's lost reasonable use of it. Let's look at other takings today. Being a surveyor, I'm familiar with a lot of them. Mostly they come under the guise of what's called wetlands. And they say you can't use that land. But it's kind of sneaky how they do it, because they use the third party. So the federal government tells the state governor tells the county government that if somebody wants to develop their property, and the only time they take it is when you want to do something with the property. So if you want to build a house, if you want to put a driveway in, if you want to do anything, you go down and you have to fill out an application to improve the property. Once you've done the application, you've submitted, you've sought a benefit from the agency. So they say, okay, now we need you to go out and do this expensive survey and determine where wetlands exist on your property. There's no wetlands. I don't care how hard it rains, it's dry the next day. You still have to do this survey. And then they do the survey, and then they find out that it's not just if there's standing water, but there's certain vegetation that is included in wetlands. And there are other characteristics of soil that might include it within wetlands. And all of a sudden, then the county comes back with no lawful authority. It says, well, you can't develop unless you give us this land or jump through these hoops and pay these fees. And so they take property for public use. You know, it's not for public use, but they're taking the property from the people, and the people have to pay for the privilege of giving it to them. Where's the justice in that? What do you think the founders would say? So due process is something that doesn't exist anymore in terms of how it was understood by the founding fathers. They had an equitable justice system. We have an inequitable justice system. The government wins no matter what. Plea bargains is another way they win no matter what. They badger you and drain your family resources and finally say, look, I'll tell you what, you plead guilty to this, we'll give you 5, 10, 15 years in prison, but we won't go after your daughter or your wife. And that's happened in Beecher and Massey. Now, Massey's not going to play, though. He and Christie have talked it over, and they ain't going there. But that's not due process. That's not justice. A plea agreement should be illegal.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
it is not due process. It does not put you before the jury. But they burden you with expense. Burden you with threats to other members of your family who might have knowledge of your criminal activity for not turning you in. Oh wait, that was Germany. No, that's here.
It's a war of attrition. I think is what you're pointing out. And
I call it badgering, and this goes back to years ago when I was surveying. They would try and badger people to get them to give up their property, and I would fight from. In one case, they said, you got to give up those roads. The guy owned a whole block, and they wanted roads on all four sides. And they tried to ascribe it to a certain act where the land had gone back to the government and then come back to them. But they had the road on the wrong side of the property. And so he ended up, his attorney gave up, but I persisted. And he got $124,000 for the land that they wanted him to give them.
Well, this is a large part of the reason why libertarians call it the criminal injustice system. And you were mentioning eminent domain just a little bit ago, where it says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. I don't see how the government trying to essentially steal somebody's home just in order to pass the land off to some sort of developer who wants to just put up a mall there counts as public use.
Let's go to Hartford, Connecticut, where the entire block was taken. And it's still there. The city had to pay for it. The developers never bought it from the city. So the city ate the cost of litigation. They ate the cost of the land. And the people lost their homes because it was not for a public use. Public use, canals, even train or road rights away. Even public utilities, where the service is to the public, not indirectly by what they expected in Hartford was an increase in the tax base. Instead, they got stuck with the cost of this land quite expensively, and they've got nothing to do with it. At least the city doesn't have to pay taxes on it. But except for that, they're out the money they paid for that land, and it's still vacant. They've got to maintain it now and keep it in a healthy condition, get rid of the rats and everything else. And that you're right, that's not public good. The eminent domain was very specific for centuries, but hey, our government likes to redefine where the grand jury sits in the Fourth Amendment, what an oath or affirmation means. I mean, these ones I look at on these cases, they don't even swear that it's true. They just sign it like a letter. And I guess that protects them from perjury, but I doubt the government would ever charge them with perjury, but maybe a good attorney could. But since they didn't swear to it, it's not perjury. It's just a letter. So yeah, the justice system is non-existent in this country today. When I look back and read what was intended by the founders, they wanted something that was just and fair to the people, that did not give the government an arbitrary right that the king was assuming in many situations in this country, but not nearly to the extent that they do now in this country. So, it's gone.
Well, I mean, consider too also how the different bar attorneys have been trying to obfuscate or otherwise obscure the right and proper power of the jury to judge the laws as well as the facts, regardless of the judge's instructions to them. Basically, jury nullification.
Yes, many states in their original constitutions and some in their current constitutions make clear, Maryland is one, makes clear that the jury judges both law and fact. Now, they didn't put those words in the federal constitution. I'm sure they understood it, that that's the way it works. They didn't see the need to. In fact, I think in Maryland, when I look back at the earlier constitution, they did not have that. In the second constitution, they put that judge on both law and fact in. Because, apparently it was getting obscured somehow. So they saw the need to reintroduce the clarification of what the right of a jury was. We go to Lysander Spooner's 1828 essay, which is in the library as well, at outpostoffreedom.com. And he says that they have right to judge both fact and law, the law. So here's another instance where what was what the founders thought they were leaving their posterity has been ripped out and thrown away.
The first part of the Sixth Amendment says that in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed. So there's already at least four qualifications or characteristics. It's got to be an impartial, speedy public jury trial.
Yeah, and speedy right now, look at Massey's, Wolf's case.
He's been locked up for several months at least, since March, and since September.
I wrote the article, but I'm getting old, my memory slips some, but let me find it. The evidence in Wolf's case, when we finally got this information, we knew it was, there was something seriously wrong here, but the charge against William Wolfe is possession of an automatic shotgun that he purchased from FBI agents. Disregard all the rest of it. Here's the extensive record that requires an extension of another 60 days. Now, Wolfe will be close to a year in prison now on this. And the trial set for the, I think, the I get early November, and when he was arrested in March, so only 11 months, I guess, 10 months. But there were 524 pages of written discovery documents. 524 pages. There were 17 DVDs relating to recorded conversations and podcasts, and there were text messages and phone logs. Now, the 17 DVDs, a little simple math. If they were all video, that's 102 hours of video or 2.5 work weeks. For buying a shotgun? Or, if we look at audio, it's 1,224 hours. And that's over 300, or over 30 work weeks. 30 work weeks. You go to work 40 hours a week, that's over 30 work weeks, or a combination of the two. But the worst case, let's say it's all video. You got a 2.5 weeks, work weeks, of video to get a guy. Oh, wait, they said text messages and phone logs related to recorded conversations and podcasts. Oh, perhaps the target isn't the shotgun protect. Perhaps the shotgun is the means of denying him. What was that First Amendment one? Freedom of speech. That was it. Yeah. Maybe that's a way that we can deny him freedom of speech because we can't control what he says, but we don't like what he says. So let's sell him a shotgun and bust his ass.
Sounds like political targeting to me.
It is. And Sunday's, well, this is time sensitive, so can't say that. So anyway, we're at the, all criminal prosecutions, accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial. Public trial. Wait a minute. Public means the public can go in. And now, that's that word, that verbicide. The worst verbicided word in our language is public because we think it belongs to the government. So we read that and government trial. But they restrict documents. They restrict access. You know, on PACER, there are court documents I can't get. That's part of the trial. It's public. How come they're sealed? How can you possibly seal it? How can we know that justice is being served when you've got these secret documents going back and forth between the court and an attorney? We're the public, damn it.
Yeah. I know that there are, you know, some libertarians who are very big in the so-called police accountability movement, but if there was any branch of government that really needed some serious transparency because we honestly just don't know what's going on and we really need that information, it would be the judicial branch. If we need transparency with anything, it's transparency in the courts, quite frankly, because we need to get the documents with however they're prosecuting, or would that be persecuting these different folks who have essentially become political prisoners.
It has become what we just said about Wolf. That's persecution. They don't the way he talks, so they trick him into buying a shotgun. They switch it to an automatic and charge him more for it. Bait and switch, they call it. And as soon as he takes it and puts it in his truck, they arrest him. Wait. But let's continue on here. By an impartial jury. Wait, a partial jury. So that means, and the last time I went for jury duty, it was in Phoenix, Arizona. And the question that everybody was asked is, do you believe a law enforcement officer always tells the truth on the stand? And anybody that said no, or not always, or anything that wasn't a positive response to that, was grilled until they found a way to kick them off the jury.
That sounds like jury tampering to me.
It takes the impartiality out of it. It's a partial jury at that point, because you find people that are on side of the law and order. Did I say that? It becomes a partial jury because they've manipulated the jury selection process to the benefit of, first, the state, but second, there's somebody that can beat that, and that's a rich client that can afford hire these jury selection firms that can out-chest the government in jury selection. But they profile all the potential jurors. They look at their history, their records, and everything. They sit in court, they judge, and they're profiling the jurors, and they judge and determine which ones will be most favorable to their client's case. The government hasn't gotten to the level of these private firms, but hey, they might eventually. In fact, they might even buy out the private firms and make them government firms so we don't even have access to them.
I mean, the way you're describing how the jury is essentially being, essentially really being tampered with, that sounds more like a start chamber.
No, it's not tampering with, because tampering would come at, after the presentation of evidence.
Or stacking the jury is probably a better word.
Stacking the jury is very appropriate. They are. And at that point, it's removed from impartiality. And I've waited for years for the government to try and charge me something, and I can't get them to do it. Not that I'm going to go shoot somebody to do it, because I want an impartial jury of my peers.
One of the things I think is worth mentioning about jury trials in Article 7th Amendment.
Let's finish the 6th.
Okay.
Which then it requires the trial be a partial jury of the state and district where the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law and to be informed. Okay, and so that goes back to trying people in England for crimes here so they can make sure they can get a conviction. Remember the Boston Massacre. The president and the troops stood trial there. They stood trial? The king's own soldiers stood trial to a jury of public people that were impartial, but they were acquitted, except for two of them. They were charged with misdemeanor and sought sanctity of the church, I think, and got a brand on their thumb. That was it. And to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation. Now, this is interesting because when I got a traffic ticket in Florida for driving without license, without tags on my motorcycle, the judge asked me, do you understand the charges against you? And I said, I don't understand the nature of the charge. And he said, well, you're driving without a license and without tags on your motorcycle. And I said, I don't understand the nature. He said, what do you mean? Is this civil or a criminal? And he said, this is traffic criminal. I don't understand the nature of the charges against me. You know, I understood the cause. They grabbed me. They stated that, no license, no tags. But the nature. And this is where we get back to what was required then. There had to be an injured party. They're not just rules of obedience. They have to have a practicality. And there's no practicality to that. But the nature of the cause of and the cause of the accusation. I mean, that's fundamental. What is the nature of the charge? Well, you broke our rules. I didn't know there were rules. Where's the rule book? I got one for Monopoly, but I don't have one for the government. To be confronted with witnesses against him, and people are often denied witnesses against them. If they do go to trial, the government will do everything they can. They'll even mask and voice disguise informants.
Yeah, that's a major problem.
To be confronted with the witnesses against him. Hey, I've got Darth Vader here. You know, he's got a mask on and his voice is real funny. And he's saying, I don't know if this is the guy that was there or not. He's lying about this conversation. I don't know if he was there. If he wasn't there, he's got to be lying. But I can't tell if he was there or not. Now, where's the justice in that?
Yeah, it actually kind of reminds me a little bit of some of the videos from some of the guys here in Texas who try to open carry their rifles when they go on their open carry walks, and somebody usually snitches to the blue coats, the cops, that, oh, there's somebody walking around with a rifle. And then during any of these police encounter videos, at some point, the guy who's open carrying asks the officer, like, you know, who's accusing me of having, you know, committed a crime? And the officer usually says something to the effect of, well, we got a call from somebody, never, of course, saying who it is. We got an anonymous tip that there was a guy walking around, so we came out to check it out, and that's why we're talking to you right now. So it's always like this amorphous, whether it's snitches or informants or just anonymous tips on the phone. You can be accused of anything, and you're not allowed to confront these witnesses.
To investigate something, that's different.
Yeah.
Now, if they do more than investigate, and they go into questioning where they have no lawful right to under the detention laws. But you know,
they do that all the time.
I think they push it. There's a guy recently. There was a YouTube video. The guy went through the He lives in California. He went through the from Arizona or Nevada into the California agricultural checkpoint. Where are you coming from? I'm not going to tell you. Where are you going? I'm not going to tell you. Do you have any plants in the car? I'm not going to tell you. And he said that they wanted to search his car. No, they wanted to inspect. That's been going on my whole lifetime. That's been going on probably back in the 20s and 30s when we became especially during the 30s when California agriculture took off and they were concerned about bringing disease in on vegetation. Those things have been there forever. And all you had to do is, look, I'm coming from Nevada. I was out here visiting friends. Where are you going? I'm going home. I live in California. Do you have any plants? No. Okay, go on. But instead, he got his cops to chase him down when he wouldn't pull over at the station, and he wouldn't roll his window down, so they broke his window out. And he did that because he was an arrogant son of a bitch. I mean, there's no reason not to cooperate, especially when they got the guns. And you can't talk the cop into the legal formalities. That's prescribed under the due process. That's a court issue. It's not a cop on the street issue. So I can't go along with these guys that want to play judge or attorney with the cop. You know, they're going to get hurt or killed or get their property damaged. I can't say the cops are right, but I think, you know, there's a discretion is the better part of valor. And these guys aren't using discretion in their belligerence. And they just always happen to have that little GoPro going at the same time.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
Yeah, I think we did a BEO on that too. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we did.
So anyway, to be confronted with the witness against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor. Now, there's another one. How do I get a witness in my favor? If Darth Vader's in there, how do I subpoena Darth Vader? I don't have his name.
I'm assuming this is where the subpoena power is based upon.
It's based upon it, but it's based on an open and fair judicial system, an open and fair administrative or police power situation. It's based on open and fairness. All of it has to be. But, you know, that's gone. Oh, national security. Oh, protection of our informants. Protection of the witness. Whatever it is. But back in the 30s, the witnesses had to testify against Al Capone. Was there risk to them? Yes, because that's when they started setting up the witness protection programs for people. So the witness, you know, they can put him in witness protection if it is serious enough and warrants it. But the thing is, the right of the defendant, the accused, to have every aspect of justice laid before him is that whole due process, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Now, this is interesting. He gets the assistance of counsel for his defense in criminal charges, but as is happening with Wolf, where the statute says anyone can file a habeas corpus, they say, well, anyone's an attorney. Now, if I'm charged with robbing a bank, they'll give me an attorney. If I'm want to challenge their right to charge me for robbing the bank, they won't give me an attorney to do that. They'll only give me a bar attorney who will never touch habeas corpus. So that sacred writ is removed from the assistance of counsel. But assistance of counsel is an interesting word. It doesn't say lawyer, and they bent that to mean bar attorney, approved by this court.
Yeah, they have. Yeah.
So again, you know, what have we talked about in these last three amendments that has any semblance of justice, any semblance of retaining even a modicum of what was intended by the founders?
No, not at all. They've all been thoroughly violated up and down the line.
Pretty much. Now let's go on to seven.
Well, again, to kind of get back to trial by jury,
Seventh Amendment had to deal with, I think they're talking about civil cases and suits of common law where the value of controversy shall exceed $20. The right of trial by jury shall be preserved.
Yes, and that is a civil case, yes. Because it's a value in controversy. It's not a damage to restitution. It's a value in controversy. So that would be a contractual issue.
Okay.
Or it could be a damage issue if you were suing to, to get the guy to pay for the garage that he burned down intentionally or something like that. But it is a civil matter. It's not one that involves crime. I didn't charge him with arson. I just wanted to pay for my damn garage. So in suits of common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, that was a long time ago.
$20 meant something back then, right?
There's been no adjustment to that, but you know I don't know if there are suits at common law anymore at all. I mean, I've tried to get the habeas corpus in under the common law, and they haven't really said the common law doesn't exist, but they keep referring to the statutes and rules and everything. And one of the legal scholars said that it has to be at common law because to remove it from common law would subject it to reinterpretation beyond its intent, something to that effect. But the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. If it exceeds $20, then the community's got to pop for it. And back then, $20 is probably like $500 today or $1,000. The right to a trial by jury to judge the contract is basically what they're saying. And it says no fact tried by jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. So the jury verdict is final in a civil action. You know, they've decided the controversy. It's a done deal. Go home.
Well, I mean, considering how those impartial, speedy, and public jury trials have already been usurped, essentially, with stacked juries and whatever else like you were describing before in the Sixth Amendment, then I don't see why the right of trial by jury can be preserved in civil cases pursuant to the Seventh Amendment.
Well, if you go into a civil matter, more than likely you're going to find yourself running against statutes, but that kind of takes it out of... Well, let's look at it this way. Article 1, Section 10 shall not impair the right of contract. However, the government has impaired the right of contract. The state has impaired the right of contract, I should say, by civil rights actions.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a contract issue, shouldn't it be civil? But no, they throw criminal statutes into a civil matter because it's a contractual issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in a sense, a lot of the concept of the ensuing common law in civil issues has been circumvented away from what was intended to come under the control of the state and or federal government.
So, Gary,
what is excessive bail?
Well, bail is intended to allow a man to walk freely, exceptions, capital offense, something like that, where your life is at stake. You take the chance and run. Money ain't gonna, I don't care if I have no money as long as I got my life. So excluding capital crimes, excessive bail is a guarantee that you will appear for trial. And if you don't, then the money will cover all costs expended by the government, any restitution or anything else as a consequence of your acts. Is $100,000 bail for stealing donuts excessive? Hell yes. If the donuts are $5 a dozen and I stole two dozen, that's 10 courts time. We could be $500 or $1,000. But the idea is if you flee from justice, well, let's look at a civil case. If I want an injunction against somebody, more than likely I'm going to have to post a bond. And that bond would include both the anticipated or the sought damages and the attorney's fees and the court costs, those three things. So attorney's fees on the other guy's side, say $4,000, the punitive, or the real damages, say $2,000, so we're $6,000, court costs $2,000, that's $8,000. So $10,000 wouldn't be excessive, would it? Because it would, if I fled, if I didn't appear in court and abandoned it, where I could be penalized and have to pay the restitution, it's covered, but my failure to appear automatically defaults to the other side. In a criminal matter, it should be similar. It's excessive if it goes beyond what is reasonable to cover the restitution. Now, we've gotten away from restitution because insurance companies cover everything now, and now everything's based on punitive. The government wants to fucking punish you. That's all there is to it. They want their pound of flesh. But excessive bail, I see it all the time. You take some guy that, you know, he probably doesn't have $1,000 in cash in the bank, is in his socks or in his drug pocket. But they set a bail of $1 million. That doesn't make sense. And that's definitely excessive. I've not seen anybody challenge it. I'd love to see somebody challenge it. What is the possible cost if I flee? This is the restitution. our penal system is not based on punishment as much as justice and fairness, both for the injured party and the criminal. But this is one of those badgering things, because if I do $1 million bond, you've got to come up with $100,000. You could probably work a deal on $1 million to maybe $70,000 or $80,000 to pay the bail bondsman, but you never get that back. So 10%, generally 10% of the bond. They put $1 million bond on these guys down in Waco, the bikers. They don't even know if they, you know, they just gathered them up. Here, round them up and herd them over here. And they got everybody in the circle and then started dumping them in paddy wagons. And they were all put out on $1 million bond. That's excessive as hell. They don't even have a crime against these people. They don't have anything to justify what they did. But, hey, screw that. That doesn't matter where the government, and just shut up and get in the paddy wagon.
And I would assume the same would apply about excessive fines too, then.
Excessive fines, too. Yes, fines are generally are nominal. They're supposed to be a discouragement against future actions. And I think most fines I've seen imposed possibly fall in that realm. But, I don't look at fines. I'm not familiar with them. I don't know what... I probably have it, but I don't think I looked at any fine that was imposed on Beecher. Massey and Wolf were not there yet. But if we look at statutes, they got some pretty fucking high ones. You know, $5,000 and or 5 years in prison. You know, it's... If it covers the cost of prosecution, it would make sense, unless they put $1 million or tens of millions of dollars like they did against McVeigh, but they couldn't find him.
What are cruel and unusual punishments?
Well, capital is not criminal, because we talked about capital. And capital only has one meaning, that if you're found guilty, you are potentially subject to execution. That's a capital crime. Doesn't mean that necessarily. There used to be litigation mitigation. We still have it in a sense, but we do it differently now. But you found guilty, and now there's a rule book on the term that you serve, and there's points here and points there and all that. And it takes a couple months to get the pre-sentencing report. They go through this very extensive thing to do it. And I think that's cruel and unusual in itself, because it doesn't leave it to the jury. Yes, he did do that, but under the... Let's go back to England. Stole a loaf of bread to feed his kids. They arrested him. He never saw his kids or his wife again, and he was shipped off to America as an indentured servant. Now, that's cruel and unusual. But isn't it the same thing, cruel and unusual, when you grab a guy off the street, throw him in jail, and start eking away at his financial resources? Wait, even before he's convicted. Don Massey, I've got that article, cruel and unusual punishment prior to conviction. This says, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Punishments is a concept... A post-conviction concept. You don't punish innocent until proven guilty. You can't impose punishments until there's guilt. But now, in the aspect of badgering, burdening people so they'll plea agreements so we don't have to go to trial, because we might lose the case because we did a shitty job. We violated the law. We lied, cheated, and stole to get there. So this cruel and unusual punishment before, and Massey was having a hell of a time. He's an independent electrician, but he had to call to leave the house. He couldn't go try cold sale on people, drive up to people who were doing construction and say, do you need an electrician, things like that. He had to call in and say, I'm going here. They took away his right to make a living. They made it burdensome as hell. And I can understand it. You know, I had my own business, and I can understand it. If I had to get permission to cold call a potential client to see if I could do work for him. You know, I'd drive by construction site, and stop and say, is the owner here? Yeah, he's over there. And I go talk to him, you know, next time you do a job, I'd like to submit a bid for the design, surveying and engineering work. And, oh, give me your card. You know, that's cold calls. And electricians do that too, especially small independent ones, because they don't get the big contracts. So he couldn't even do that because I want to know who you're going to go see and how long you're going to be there, when you're going, all this, where the location is so we can follow you on the GPS tracker. And this is cruel and unusual, and he hasn't been convicted yet. So he got frustrated and spoke to joint, ended up back in solitary confinement. So fines imposed are cruel and unusual punishment inflicted. You know, that's out the window, too. I don't know about the fines. Quite frankly, I don't. I see that they give themselves the authority. They give a limit, a top end. Whether they impose them, maybe I should go back and look at Beecher's plea agreement. But
when I was preparing my article on that explored civil asset forfeiture, one thing I kept seeing in a lot of documents and even a few court cases was that there was a couple of innocent property owners who had tried to challenge the constitutionality of the civil forfeiture based on the excessive fines clause in the Eighth Amendment. And it didn't always work, unfortunately. Sometimes somebody would be able to get, let's say, their truck back, and other times somebody else lost their house.
Well, civil asset forfeiture, property cannot be taken for public use without just compensation or something like that, right?
You're referring back to eminent domain in the Fifth Amendment.
No, it didn't say eminent domain. It never mentions eminent domain. Property cannot be taken. Let me find it. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, let's look at eminent domain. In Hartford, for example, the idea was financial gain. That was the entire purpose. That's what they argued was the public use, an increase in tax revenue. But instead, they got stuck with hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in cost to purchase property that still sits idle and they have to maintain it. If they take your car or your house under asset forfeiture, they have taken your property for public use, whether they use the house or sell it, because that economic interest was established in the Hartford case. So, I'm sorry, on the Fifth Amendment, we did not discuss that, because I was looking at the wording more than looking at the application now. But asset forfeiture, somebody tries to seize my asset, I'll blow his fucking head off. I have a right to protect myself against highwaymen. And if they're not abiding by the law and they're taking my property for public use without just compensation, I'll blow their fucking head off.
The main problem with civil forfeiture, I mean, again, we're not talking about criminal forfeiture, which of course requires the government to at least go through the what they would probably consider the song and dance of due process.
Be taken for public use. That would be civil.
It might be different
if it's proceeds of a crime as part of the restitution.
Right, that would be criminal. That would be criminal forfeiture requiring a conviction. Right, but the problem with civil forfeiture is they just steal the property outright, and they don't charge the innocent property owner with anything. They just take the property.
Taken for public use. That's my whole point. That's it right there.
Okay.
They have taken the house, the car, the cash.
They've also taken computers, jewelry. I mean, anything that's basically
their own personal use. If a cop takes your money out of your car and sticks it in his pocket, that's theft.
There have been police departments convicted of that. I think there was like the proceeds of some civil forfeitures. I think went for like a margarita machine somewhere in Texas, if I remember right.
But once he turns his money over to the authorities, it's taken for public use.
I see what you mean.
Wait,
okay.
What constitution are we talking about? We're the government. So when are we going to defend our property? Like I said, if they tried to take mine, I would blow their fucking head off. If it cost me my life, I would blow their fucking head off, because unless we stand against the abuses of government and stealing property without just compensation, they're highwaymen at that point. They're criminals. I don't care if it's public, for public use, or they're going to put my house in their damn pocket. They're stealing it because this says they can't take it unless they compensate me. So when they take it, that becomes criminal by the very act itself. They can call it civil, traffic criminal court. I don't understand the nature of the charges against me. What is traffic criminal? It's the same thing here. They can call it civil. That doesn't change the nature of theft, does it?
No, it doesn't.
And I guess what I was thinking about in the excessive fines clause under the Eighth Amendment was that when you do have innocent property owners in a civil forfeiture proceeding, try and litigate to get their property back, they have to file so many pieces of paper and they have to pay court costs just to contest the civil forfeiture itself. Arguably, all those cumulative court costs might very well indeed be excessive fines.
They go down and they talk to the county or the city and they say, well, what do I have to do to get it back? Go to this court and file a case. Now, once I file the case, I've submitted to an administrative agency and now I'm bound by the rules, right?
Unfortunately, that would seem to be the case.
The problem there.
Yeah.
No, I want my property back and I'm not going to file in court. You have taken my property for public use without just compensation. This is not litigation. This is not justiciable. This is a fact. You took my property for public use without compensation. I want the compensation. Now, if we are going to enter the courtroom solely to determine the value of that property, then I will proceed. But beyond that, to try and justify that you don't have the right to do that, you don't have the right by the Fourth Amendment, which one? Fifth Amendment.
Yeah.
You don't have the right. But, you know, people don't challenge it that way. They go to a lawyer and say, what do I do? Well, in law school, they told me you got to do this. Okay, well, I guess I'll do that.
Yeah, and they do that
under the auspices of assistance of counsel in the Sixth Amendment, which, of course, is a perversion.
What is assistance of counsel? It doesn't say that I'm going to have somebody speak for me. I'm with the assistance.
Right.
But look at with Wolf. I can talk to Massey every day. Sometimes we talk two or three times a day. The Wolf, he can't call me. My letters take over a week to get to him. It takes over a week to come back. Massey gets the letters quicker than Wolf does. And I'm closer to Wolf than I am to Massey.
Does the cruel and unusual punishments clause prohibit torture then?
I would say definitely. Now, torture is a tool to encourage obedience. But, you know, it's interesting that we can torture people, but we can't have them build roads or clean ditches or pick up trash on the side of the road anymore.
Mm.
Well, what's wrong with this picture? That's not punishment. That's earning his keep. Orange County, Florida, when I was county surveyor, a lot of orange groves were deeded to the county upon the death of the owner that had no descendants, no heirs. And some of them specified that they were deeded to the county jail to provide food for the inmates. And so they used to go out and pick the oranges as part of their duties. And they'd sell some to offset the cost of buying meat and things like that. Jails tended to be more self-sustaining by building roads and things like that, cutting costs that would otherwise go to people for labor by feeding these prisoners, giving them a pick or a shovel and having them work. That's not a cruel and unusual punishment. It's historical punishment. It goes back again centuries in England as well. But they've stopped that because they said it was cruel and unusual. But at the same time, we've got the same government that if we want information out of somebody, and face it, if you're tortured enough, you'll tell them, what do you want me to say? What do you want me to sign? I'll sign it. Stop torturing me. So they're saying they're getting reliable information. How do they know they're getting reliable information? Because they won't tell us what information they got, what information they used. But yes, that would be cruel and unusual punishment. But let's go back one step further. That's punishment, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Punishment has to come after conviction, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, if due process is to be respected, yeah.
Yeah, there's
the problem one more time. Well, in that case, does waterboarding constitute torture?
I would say so when somebody fears for his life and a natural reflex. I watched that video and I've read about waterboarding. And, you know, drowning is one thing I don't want to do because You know, there was a lifeguard once that wanted to see what it was like to drown. And he got frantic. There's just a natural reaction that at one point your body just collapses. And they were watching him. They rushed him to the surface because he was about ready to gulp in water. When you're inverted and water fills your nose like that, and the natural reaction is, let's call it a gag instinct. And that is a reaction, a natural reaction to anticipated death, the anticipated potential for death. Now, is it cruel to, say, take a gun and put one round in it, a revolver, spin it around and point it at the guy's head? Is that cruel and unusual?
Probably, if you then pull the trigger.
They call that Russian roulette, yes.
Well, if you put the round in, spin the revolver, and then you press the trigger,
even if you don't squeeze
I would assume so.
When you put it to his head, whether you squeeze the trigger or not, when you put it to his head, there's anticipation of death. Is that torture? There are two ways of torture, fear of death or excruciating pain.
Waterboarding
would be more of the pain
side. That's a natural reflex. That's fear of death.
Oh, okay.
You know, the screws, the rack, pulling your toenails out. Those are excruciating pain. But fear of death, the Russian roulette and the waterboarding are fear of death.
Okay.
Because your gag, your natural reaction when you get that water is, I'm drowning. And the lifeguard, after he went through that, said, I'll never do that again. That was the scariest thing in my life. I forgot all the circumstances, but he was weighted down, dropped in a pool, just slightly weighted down so that they could lift him back to the surface rapidly. And there were two or three guys standing by. But the idea is he was going to go down there. And I don't recall what the signal he was supposed to give, but when that reaction got to him, he didn't give the signal. But instead, they saw his actions and raised him to the surface based on his reaction. That was fear of death. And it overrode the thought process of saying, I've got to give the signal. I've read about that about 15, 20 years ago, so I don't remember all the details, but I do remember this guy said, I would never do that again. That was the scariest thing that's ever happened in my lifetime.
You had mentioned the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. What is the significance of the Ninth and Tenth Amendments?
Well, it says if we didn't give it to the, if we gave it the first, ninth, if it's given in the Constitution, we have it. If it's not given to the Constitution, we still have it. Unless it's taken away by the Constitution. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So when we gave them the Constitution to create a government, especially the federal government, remember the distinction between federal and state. They didn't want an overarching federal government that ruled everything. God damn, how did we get here? I'm not sure. So some rights were enumerated in the Constitution, especially, and I think the most significant, is habeas corpus. But if they're not enumerated, they were concerned that they're going to say, well, we gave you these rights, but it wasn't a matter of them giving them. They were enumerated to be protected. But they were afraid the government would say, well, we gave you these, so the rest of them you don't have. So this is written specifically, the concern was that if we list these. Now, there were debates on that in the Constitutional Convention and in subsequent Congress discussing the Bill of Rights. That some said you don't need them because we've only given certain powers to the government. Now, what have we been talking about all evening? The government abrogating their responsibility and usurping authority, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was intended to deny, to prohibit that. The enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Now, what did we retain? We retained anything that we didn't give to the government. It didn't just disappear. If we had a right, it didn't disappear because we created a government. So we either gave it to them or did not. And if we did not, it's retained by us.
Hold on. So it was pretty absolute.
It covered the entire spectrum of anything that wasn't specifically excluded by the Constitution and subsequently the Bill of Rights.
Does the Tenth Amendment imply that the federal government is limited in its powers rather than the several state governments?
Are we done with the Ninth?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, now we go on the Tenth. Power is not delegated to the United States. The Constitution delegated powers and authorities to the United States. Powers and authorities, two things. And they also imposed limitations. Did they cover everything? Hell, this is the first time this is done in history. And we know they didn't because they had two amendments within a decade or a little more than a decade. But the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. Any power not given to them specifically, where we have delegated either the states or the people's rights, if we have not, same as the Ninth in that respect, if we have not given them a power. But see, one's looking from the right side, and the other one is looking from the power side. You know, the both sides of the coin, so to speak. The power is not given to the government by the Constitution. Now, Article 1, Section 10 prohibits the states from doing certain things, right?
Yes.
Can't, titles of nobility, impair the right of contract. So the power is given, not given to the government and not prohibited by it to the states, are reserved for the states, respectively, or the people. So if they're not prohibited from the states, but they're not delegated to the federal government, then it would be to the people that they're retained. And now, depending on their state constitution and their state legislation, would determine whether the states were granted that those powers and authorities or whether they still remain in the hands of the people. So there's a descending order. If it's not given the federal government, and it's not restricted to the states, then the states reserved it unless the people have not granted it to the states. In that case, the people retain it.
Now hold on.
Does the Tenth Amendment imply that the federal government, the central government on the Potomac, as it were, is more limited than the several states of the Union?
No, not more limited. The limitations are listed in Article 1, Section 9, Article 1, Section 8, Article 1, Section 9, and the state then in Article 1, Section 10. It's all laid out. Now, did we miss anything? Anything that we missed, whether it's a right retained, 9, or a power granted, 10, anything, if it's not mentioned in the Constitution, is reserved to the states or the people. When it's a right, the right goes to the people. They can give it to the state if they want to, which they have in their Second Amendment, where they've had qualifiers on them. But on the powers delegated, they go to the states because the state was a government. It's the sovereign entity. It's the principal government of the people, except with regard to those powers delegated to the United States government, where it was necessary to put it in a national relationship. And that's national defense, commerce, the way it was intended, not the way it's applied. Those powers were given to the federal government because they could not be to a state. If the state had the right to do tariffs, they could punish other states. National defense, how can you have national defense? The state has the right to defend itself, but if it gets bad enough, the United States government has to take over and repel the invader. So the general government, as it was called, had very limited powers, but let's look at some of the others. Determine the value of money. To punish copyright violations, to punish piracy, to punish counterfeiting, things like that. Those had to be, if you read 1-8, you'll see they all had to be given to the federal government because each state would have a different opinion, therefore you would have unequal application, and it would be difficult to have commerce between two states if one said silver's worth 50 cents and the other one said silver's worth a dollar. You know, there had to be a stabilizing force in the Confederation, in the Union, and what they sought to do then is to provide those powers and authorities to provide that stability and no more. It was never, let's go back to the preamble, so that it not be misunderstood that the government has limited powers.
So would the phrasing in the 10th Amendment also imply or at least give a hint that, you know, depending on the subject matter, that one should consult one of the several state constitutions then?
Well, there definitely, it depends on who you're dealing with. If you're dealing with federal government within their lawful powers and authorities, you have to refer to the federal constitution. And what I read you about this, this new motion on massing, hey, for them to go to intrastate is a violation of the 10th Amendment because that was retained by the state because it was not delegated to the federal government because the Second Amendment shall not be infringed. So all they can do is control commerce when it's intrastate. Now we're back to militia, and I have a right to that firearm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't transport it. I can't receive it in interstate. You know, the analogy used in that Liberty Law article is transporting in interstate commerce is an overpass over the road. There's a stairway up and a stairway down. On each one goes up on one side of the road and down on the other. That's commerce. But once it gets in the sidewalk, it's intrastate. And so it's out of the realm of the powers granted to the federal government under the Commerce Clause.
So why are the 11th through 27th Amendments not also referred to as the Bill of Rights?
Well, because the demand for the Bill of Rights, I mean, the other ones, the first one, the next one, the judicial power of the United States, they saw that in writing in the Article 3, they saw that what they had written was not workable. So they made an adjustment to determine where federal jurisdiction existed. Now, if you read both Article 3 and the 11th Amendment, you'll find that they don't have the power to make it criminal. They can only tax, and this goes back to 1934, they can only tax you for interstate commerce, but they've made it criminal. But this was an adjustment because there was a failure. They recognized that within 5 years and a degree of confusion over who could have original jurisdiction in the federal court system. But by this time, look now, the federal government has assumed judicial jurisdiction anywhere and everywhere. And that's exactly what we're challenging in Massey's case. Mm-hmm. So it was not a Bill of Rights. It's a clarification or a resolution of an apparent flaw in the procedure that was developed in the Philadelphia Convention and ratified by the states. The 12th, the same thing. There was a problem because whoever got the most votes was president. Whoever got the second most votes was vice president. So you've got a vice president that might have, say, now I think they voted for two, so the president could have 54% and the vice president 53%. Well, the vice president sure would like to see the president dead, so he became president, right?
Yep, there's a direct incentive.
They were in opposition to each other by that very process, and they realized that this is a bad process. So let's change the electoral process to something more equitable, that we're going to have somebody run for president and somebody run for vice president, and they can't be from the same state. So now we've got a team in the executive branch rather than opponents. And it makes sense. And really, I'm surprised that they didn't consider that at the convention. But, you know, this is a new process. They never elected kings. And they were used to the idea of opposition within legislative bodies, the House of Lords or the House of Commons, or even in their own assemblies. And, you know, they had a royally appointed governor in most cases. Some of the governors, I think, were appointed under the holders of the charter. So they didn't have this conflict for the executive position. So they said, hey, highest vote got, second highest vote given. But that became problematic because you've got two people working against each other. So we have to create a team out of this. Now, it doesn't mean that I'd have to refresh it, but I think that you could have a vice president elected who was in opposition to the president, was not on the same team, but at least he wasn't competing for the president position and the animosity over losing what exists. But see, that was further changed by the 22nd Amendment, I think. So these aren't rights. So they wouldn't go in the Bill of Rights. Now, 9 and 10 aren't really rights protected, but they do deal with the preamble, the intention, making clear the intention of the Bill of Rights. The two that were not ratified, one became the 27th Amendment just a decade or so ago, in the 90s, I think.
Well, Gary, I think the last question I have for you tonight is that, what effect did the 17th Amendment have on the Constitution?
It made a major change. Hamilton even wrote about, we've got a republic and a democracy. The republic is the representative process in the House of Representatives, where every group of equal population is represented through a representative, votes as well, represents their interests. The Senate, however, is a democracy because everybody's equal. Every state has two votes. Now, the 17th Amendment, and the state was represented. The important thing is the state had an interest in this. And let's look at it this way. Suppose the federal government's proposing a tax increase. Now, the representatives might or might not go along with it. It has to initiate with them and all this. But what effect is that going to have on a state? Now, we've got all these state entitlement programs now where federal matching funds, green mail. But if the people in a state said, look, if you vote for that, you're not going to have your office next year. So you better tell our senators to oppose that. The interest of the people in that state were expressed in that Democratic House, the Senate, where everybody had an equal vote. So the state government, the member states of the Union, the United States Constitution created a confederation of 13 states, then 14, then now we got 16. So the members are the states, but the states have lost their vote with the 17th Amendment. So now they're elected at large just in the states where the representatives are by district, but they're elected by the general population. So they're really, in a sense, no different than the House of Representatives, except they have a larger constituency. So their interest now is to serve the public, not the state. So the members of the union have lost their participation in the self-government aspects created by the Constitution, where they were the members. So they're, in a sense, you could call the states members without a vote at this point.
Well, Gary, I'd like to thank you for really spending the time with me to really examine the United States Bill of Rights and really going, what I really appreciate is you really taking the time with me to really just go line by line, really, and just examine, you know, what these amendments really entail, and probably equally as important, how the federal government has essentially violated pretty much every clause in this Bill of Rights.
Well, Sleepy, I'd kind of guess that I have read the Constitution and the Bill of Rights at least 10 times more than 99% of the people in this country. And because it's become, you know, I want to understand what they intended. That's instrumental. You know that from my other work. And so I've gone where I could to find what substantiates, what indicates what the historical conditions were that led to each one of these amendments, to the extent that the information is available. You know, every once in a while I run across something new that enlightens me. And, you know, occasionally it it proves that I was in error in my evaluation of the previously gotten information. But I think generally I've gotten past that point where pretty much everything is a degree of confirmation. So what good is that knowledge to me unless I share it? So.
Well, in any case, Gary, I'd like to thank you, and I think I'll have some more questions for you later. But I think for now, this is a good place to kind of to reflect on what exactly does this mean in the larger scheme of things, that the federal government can't even abide by even what they claim is according to their own laws, what are our natural liberties are, whether it's free speech or keeping and bearing arms or whatever else. So again, Gary, I'd like to thank you.
Well, let me remind you of what we've discussed in this. At one point in time, I thought that there was one amendment to the Constitution in the Bill of Rights that had not been violated.
Third Amendment.
I was wrong. So every one of them has been violated by the government at this time, and I think we pretty well discussed that. Now, I will say the Third Amendment, not to the extent it's only an occasional situation, but it's still contrary to the Third Amendment. But the others, you know, we've discussed it. They have just walked all over this document. They wiped their ass with it.
Use it for toilet paper, right?
Yeah, I'd like to jam it down their throats. Print it on canvas, twice the original size, and jam it down their throats. But yeah, they've trashed this. We've discussed the Constitution and where they've trashed that as well. Now, of course, the Supreme Court says I'm wrong.
Of course they would.
That didn't really begin occurring until after they adopted case law in 1870s. So they're not abiding by the Constitution and the rulings at this point.
Well, what I'm looking forward to, Gary, is that later when we reconvene, what are the long-term implications of all this? And so, again, just I guess I'll just bid you goodnight then.
Okay, well, thanks for the invitation. I enjoyed it.
Okay, goodnight.
Okay, goodnight.